Fall is all about cozy comforts, and with Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your favorites and still hit your health goals. From breakfast bagels and meal-prepped enchiladas to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles, you won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at hero.co. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on hero.co for more information.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In their new book, Mothman, author and researcher Richard Estep has joined forces with renowned Mothman researcher Tobias Weiland for a new look on the mysteries of Point Pleasant and one of our favourite flying cryptids. In this new book, they document first-hand witness accounts and conduct investigations of sightings, hoping to encounter the famous flying cryptid themselves. Their discoveries include large concentrations of sightings in the Chicago and Lake Michigan area, suggesting that where the mysterious Mothman may reside is not at all linked purely to Point Pleasant. But before we join them, don't forget, of course, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. And you can also click the link in the show notes as well. Thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support me and the show with your contributions. It is always greatly appreciated. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise site is available via TeePublic, and you'll find the link for that in the show notes as well. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork, and the show is produced by Mr. Brennan Stahl of the Ghost Story Guys. Let's join my guests as we unpick the mystery, and much more besides, of Mothman and his flying brethren. Strange flying creatures seem to have captivated people all over. Yet the northern states of the USA seem to be ground zero for some of these reports. Are they flesh and blood creatures, ultra-terrestrials, aliens, or even tulpas? Trying to connect the dots, sieve the facts from fiction, and comprehend these strange encounters in their new book are our good friends Richard Estep and Tobias Weiland. Gentlemen, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
This is a bit of a strange conversation because obviously, Richard, your wheelhouse for many people is history and the paranormal. Tobias, you are one of the rising kings of Fortiana and high strangeness. I've spoken to you both over the years and always enjoy our time and our conversation. I always feel more knowledgeable when I've spoken to you both. You may not say the same about speaking with me, but I won't hold that against you. But how was this for you, Richard? Because obviously me and Tobias have had several conversations about many a weird thing over the years. Why did you want to do a project of this nature? Because it's completely out your wheelhouse, which I applaud your bravery for jumping in. Because if there's any mystery in the cryptid world that is a swamp, it has to be Mothman and his many flying relatives.
Well, that's exactly the reason it's not in my wheelhouse. I'm primarily a ghost guy. That's my comfort zone. And it's good to get out of your comfort zone every once in a while. So I had done In Search of Demons for Llewellyn, where I went on this epic road trip and talked to a bunch of luminaries and experts. And not to put too fine a point on it, failed to find any demons.
Yes.
So I wanted to fail to find something different next. And so Tobias and I, you know, we knew each other from a bunch of conferences, and we were on very good terms, you know, we were friends, I think. And when I started thinking about it, I wanted an experienced guide in those murky waters of Mothman and Fortiana. And his was the first and only call that I made. This is someone who is a very knowledgeable investigator, great all-around human being, and someone that I felt I could go on this lengthy journey with without one of us wanting to murder the other. So it seemed like a natural choice.
How did it feel for you, Tobias? Because I suppose, would you say there was a little bit of pressure for you? Because this is your realm, as it were. You are sort of Richard's conduit into the world of high strangeness, as it were. Did you feel a little bit of pressure in regards to discussing some of these subjects and these situations? Because regardless whether it's the Lake Michigan cases, the other sporadic sightings that have been in pockets all around, as I said, some of the northern states, obviously there are reports from other places. Was it one of those where you thought, how strange will Richard let me talk to him, really?
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because it never really occurred to me to be concerned about being too weird, because I mean, seriously, at this point, it doesn't even cross my mind. I just take for granted that people know that I'm going to be super weird, and if they don't expect it, then that's their problem. That's on them. But you know, honestly, I found Richard to be very open-minded, and I don't think there was ever an issue at all with, oh no, this is too weird. You know, I think people who are interested in these subjects, they like to try to put people in boxes, you know, categorize everybody. But, you know, and I'm sorry, I hate talking about you like you're not here, Richard, but this is true. Like, Richard isn't just a ghost guy. Like, he's written a wonderful book on UFOs. He's working on other cryptid stuff. And I think that something that is becoming more popular and certainly more prevalent in this field as we move further into the 21st century is the recognition of the myriad commonalities between these phenomena. And so I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this kind of thing. I think people are much more willing and maybe even able to step outside of their particular boxes and explore new territory, which I think is fantastic.
Mm. I suppose it's a bit sad, I think, that Kiel's not still with us to be able to see how popular the concept of high strangeness and zones of weirdness are becoming, because he did seem to be ploughing a lone furrow in his writings throughout his career, that a lot of people, as you refer to there, Tobias, are very sort of everything fits in certain boxes. And I know before I did this show, which is 6.5 years ago, I have to say, I always considered myself to be quite an open-minded Fortean. And then within about a year, I realised, well, I wasn't. I'd got an unconscious bias running through things I was interested in and what I thought certain things were. And yet, through doing this show and getting to know other researchers, and obviously we've got a couple of really weird areas here in the UK that I've managed to visit with some researchers out there, some of the concepts that Kiel postulated on, building a lot on some of the earlier work of Charles Fort from the beginning of the 20th century, it would probably be the best time for John Kiel to be around and writing would be now, rather than obviously him passing back in 2009, sadly.
Well, I think that the best time to be writing is always now. And and we don't really get to pick and choose our own era. I will say this, that recognition of all of this high strangeness, people referring to things as flaps and window areas and all that stuff. And even the, honestly, even some of the existence of Charles Fort in the popular consciousness, a lot of that doesn't happen if we don't have John Kiel existing in the era that he did. We needed him to be in the 1960s and the 1970s. We needed him writing his books at those time, or at that time, for us to have something to build on going forward. And so I can't speak for him, and I think that probably most people who have passed on you know, might have some regret, or maybe they would choose to be alive if they could. But I don't know that this is the best time. I think right now at best for us, if we're doing our jobs, the most we can hope for is to contribute even a fraction of what people like Charles Fort and John Keel did. So in 30, 40, 50 years from now, somebody might look back and go, oh, hey, do you think Tobias Weiland and Richard Estep wish they were alive right now to be seeing like those all hats of this stuff that we're looking into?
I mean, what was your experience and understanding of Keel, Richard? Because I mean, one of the things that made me chuckle was obviously you refer to this reading list that Tobias gave you. And you kind of said at one bit, I'm not really sure what I've just read. I'm going to have to go back and read it.
Yeah, I think the vast majority of people, I first became aware of Mothman through the movie, Mothman Prophecies, which, you know, Tobias has said it before and he's right. It's pretty much unfilmable, the book.
Yes.
And he also points out that if you remove the actual Mothman content from that book, you would have at best a pamphlet. Mm. So I think that trying to get a handle on Keel, his super spectrum, his ultra-terrestrials, I was vaguely aware of some of the concepts because I think you can't dip your toes even in the waters of ufology, you know, and studies of general weirdness without being somewhat aware of Keel, without having a working knowledge. But I had the same kind of working knowledge of it that I have of the way my car runs, you know. I know that there's an engine and a transmission and four wheels and a steering wheel. But Tobias is the guy that also knows what a carburetor is for and stuff like that. So he sent me down this kind of reading list of, hey, you know, go through this kind of stuff. I ordered all of Keel's stuff overnight. He also is very militant and in a good way about reading Charles Fort, you know, Book of the Damned and stuff like that. Yeah. Because, as he likes to say, it's almost impossible to understand Keel without understanding Fort first.
Yes.
So that's a daunting background. But Tobias is kind of a walking, talking encyclopedia. So I was able to have him, and he does this so well in the book, I thought, popularize extremely complex concepts in ways that even I could understand.
Yes, absolutely. But I think Tobias is one of the strengths you've always had is that you're able to explain and clarify extremely odd circumstances in a very easily understandable manner, which I think sometimes people can get lost in the minutiae of some of Keel's thoughts and his belief systems, especially when it comes to things like ultra-terrestrials and building on the work of Fort with his Cosmic Joker, that there seems to be some kind of Malkavechian presence that's behind everything, and we're just part of the show. We just don't know what we're being performed by.
Yeah, I mean, that I think one of the issues that many people have with Keel, and they don't even know that they have this particular issue, to be honest, is they don't understand that much of his work is speculative, and you aren't necessarily supposed to take it for granted as being necessarily true, right? So you'll get people, and they really get out into the weeds in his writing. And they start to take it as gospel, and they will just adamantly insist that like Indrid Cold has everything to do with Mothman. And it's like, well, I mean, maybe, but you know, honestly, Keel as a writer, he just took that Fortean approach. It's sort of the kitchen sink approach to covering this stuff, where if any weird thing happens in the tri-state area, you just have to include it because you don't know if it's going to be relevant or not. Because frankly, we just don't understand enough about any of this to understand the relevancy of anything that is occurring alongside it. And so people read so much into that. And again, they take it for granted that it is necessarily true and relevant, when I think that the intention by Keel was just to include it, one, to be as thorough as possible, but two, just to get people thinking, you know, like it's okay to speculate about this stuff. Like speculation is an important part of discovery, you know, and you don't have to make your mind up right away. You know, honestly, the trick here is, and I think Keel could do this, and I think his intention was to hope that other people could too. The trick is to entertain an idea without wholly accepting it. And that's what you need to be able to do to read Charles Fort, to read John Keel, to read, you know, any of these sort of Fortean or high strangeness authors. You know, I would throw like some of my friends in there, like Josh Kuchin is a great example of this, you know.
Yes.
He's a guy who can absolutely entertain an idea without wholly accepting it. He has that intellectual nuance that I think is necessary to be able to properly approach these subjects. And I think if people apply that perspective to Keel's writing, then it takes on a whole new light. And there are other vistas of understanding that we can get as a result of that.
I am still surprised that people seem to take everything that Keel wrote as gospel. They can't seem to, as you refer to there, Tobias, they can't seem to sort the wood from the trees with his work. And he always reminded me of being very similar in style to Hunter S. Thompson. You could possibly say that they were both gonzo journalists, just working in very different fields. Because a lot of Keel's work is, it's not the strange events that are the story. It's Keel's front and centre. He is the main character in this. Possibly the Mothman Prophecies is the best example of this, because he seems to be experiencing all kinds of weird things, along with some of the other local residents of that time. Mary Heyer especially seems to be another person who seems to be front and centre with all the high strangeness that's going on. But I think, as you say, the problem with the Mothman Prophecies is that there seems to be about 17 different things going on at the same time. And because they're all in the same book, people seem to presume that it's all connected, whereas it could essentially just be coincidence that there are weird things happening. And as you both know, there are numerous reports of people that perhaps see strange lights in the sky and then they have a poltergeist outbreak, or they have an encounter with a weird cryptid and then suddenly they see strange lights in the sky at another time. There seems to be connections that are often overlooked because, as we've said earlier, sometimes people don't want to focus on things that are outside that box that they like to keep their interests in.
100%. You know, honestly, I'm a little curious from Richard's perspective if any of this experience has, because I have yet to ask him this, like if any of this experience has shed new light on how you approach ghosts or recognize commonalities within that field that could be related to phenomena that maybe you hadn't previously considered.
Well, it's no secret that I'm currently working on a book for Llewellyn, In Search of Bigfoot. And I'm sure you and your readers, listeners rather, are very aware. You know, there are broadly two schools of thought on Bigfoot. One is the kind of aether theory that this is a bio creature that lives, sleeps, eats, poops, all that stuff. And then there are the more, shall we say, esoteric theories, the quantum Bigfoot and so forth. And I'm really glad I did the Mothman Project first, because yes, it has broadened my horizons, the way I'm approaching this Bigfoot project. Especially something that really resonated was, you know, Tobias highlighted this concept of kind of window areas, where Keel had, you know, some parts of our world are more prone to Fortean phenomena than others. And, you know, the Ohio River Valley was such an area. I was just at an event in Virginia this past weekend, which has the trifecta: claims of hauntings, claims of Bigfoot, and claims of UFO UAP activity in the skies above. And I don't think this is a coincidence. And again, entertaining the notion that these three classes of phenomena are perhaps more related than I might have thought a few years ago has been very eye-opening for me. And I really owe that to the appreciation I have for Fort, for Keel, and Tobias's perspective on those.
I suppose, has it made you look back at certain locations and certain investigations you've been on, Richard, that perhaps because you were focused on the ghost, you weren't looking or researching other strange phenomena that was going on around it. As you say, these areas that you seem to have everything going on. And that's, you know, and that's not a criticism. I think we've all gone through that kind of phase where we start.
I actually think it is a valid criticism, Paul. I mean, medicine is my profession. I work in emergency medicine. And, you know, the old saying, if you go to a doctor, if you go to a surgeon for a consult, they're going to recommend surgery. you go to a chiropractor with your back, they're going to recommend an adjustment. When you're a hammer, you know, every problem is a nail, right? But in modern medicine, with more complex patients, you often see what we call, you know, the multidisciplinary care team, where you might consult with a pulmonologist, a cardiologist, an oncologist, a general internalist, you know. So, and I bring that up because, as you say, you know, I was in my ghostly wheelhouse for, I think it's fair to say, decades. And now I'm looking at more of an interdisciplinary approach. And fortunately, there are, although there are some very territorial people and would-be gatekeepers in the field, there are also some. Josh Hutchin is a great person to highlight, that are wonderful about being team players and sharing their expertise and wisdom with those who know less than they do. So I almost think future investigations, I'm more, not just willing, but eager to consult with people who specialize in different aspects of this phenomenon, you know, whichever it is I'm investigating.
Absolutely. I think as well, the one thing that's frustrated me over the years, Richard, when it comes to Bigfoot, is the fact that for some people it's either flesh and blood or it's ultra, you know, this quantum theory that's come into the fore over the last few years. And despite the fact that most physicists don't understand the quantum realm, never mind as applying it to paranormal phenomena. But I think as well, you've also got these aspects, and this is the one thing that always annoys me, is that you mentioned the word ghost to Bigfooters, and it seems to be the worst thing you can say to them. It's not on the agenda at all. And I know when we've spoken previously, and when I've spoken to Tobias, there are probably hundreds of thousands of ghostly reports of animals of all kinds of walks of life. I think the only thing I've yet to come across is probably a ghost fish of some description, but I'm sure you, if anybody's going to put me correct, well, Richard, it might be.
There's that great theory that the Loch Ness Monster is the ghost of a plesiosaur, right?
Yes.
Which, it's in the top 10 weirdest hypotheses I've heard for that particular cryptid, but it's not impossible. I feel like, you know, quantum is a black box and a get out of jail free card for some people. Mm-hmm. It's a black box in that we can sometimes stuff a whole bunch of things we don't understand and say, oh, that's quantum. In the same way that human beings did that with magic for years, you know, we explained away all kinds of entirely natural phenomena as simply being magic. So I think that there's a danger of quantum becoming the new magic, as it were. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Tobias?
I would agree with that. Well, first of all, okay, I have to mention this. I'm gonna put on my fun ruiner hat just real quick. I'm pretty sure that Loch Ness
literally
isn't
get a fun
old
ruiner
enough.
Hat. I want to see it.
I should get one. I'll ask for one for Christmas or something. But Emily would get me one. But I'm pretty sure that Loch Ness isn't old enough to have the ghost of a plesiosaur in it, because they were extinct before it formed. Is
exactly.
that right?
Exactly. Exactly.
You know that.
True.
Even you know that, Tobias, and you don't even live in the UK, mate. That's 100%
true.
Even me.
And yet this theory persists.
Hey, it's not the strangest thing I've heard about Nessie. No. I mean, for you as well, like Richard refers to there, it does seem to be the hot new trend, Tobias, and I've seen it apply to all kinds of Fortean disciplines over the last 5 years, not just Bigfoot. Even as we're talking here with Mothman, I've seen it used as explanations for ghosts, for UFOs. It seems to have replaced the thinning of a veil. That 10 years ago, people were talking about parallel dimensions running adjacent all the time, which is still there, and obviously there seems to be a lot more scientific thought and investigation in that particular field. I know Michio Kaku is a prime proponent of these kind of sort of overlapping things that could kind of explain why people see Bigfoot, why people see ghosts, because you've got things interacting on certain levels that occasionally those dimensions intersect in a way that whoever's wherever can see everything else that's happening at that particular time. So it does seem to be we get through these kind of sort of escape clauses when it comes to the weird. And I mean, as we say, Keel had them even in 50, 60 years ago. He still, could suggest that the ultra-terrestrials were because he was so frustrated at not being able to get nuts and bolts UFOs that he thought this can't be real. But obviously, thousands and thousands of people are seeing strange things.
Yeah, well, I think the issue is that there is a certain... I think there's a temptation to allow for a certain level of intellectual laziness or maybe dishonesty when it comes to these subjects. And that's why you get things like people trying to explain one mystery with another, for instance. The Loch Ness Monster is a great example. I mean, saying the Loch Ness Monster is a ghost gets us no closer to understanding anything about it, because it's not like we know what ghosts are. Like, that's not an explanation, guys. Like, we can do better, right?
Yeah.
And we see the same thing, you know, and I think that's part of what led to ultra-terrestrials. It's sort of this convenient hypothesis that you can use to explain anything. Now, we don't have any evidence for it, like certainly no strong evidence to support that particular hypothesis. And yet it persists because by its very nature, like, you can apply it to literally anything. You can be like, oh, Bigfoot, that was an ultra-terrestrial, because they can look like anything. Ghosts, ultra-terrestrials. They exist in the super spectrum, man. They can go through walls. They can do whatever they want. Well, okay. I mean, good luck proving it, I guess. But also, I think that there's this tendency to be reductive as a result of that, right? Because trying to explain, say, something like ghosts as ultra-terrestrials, like, what does that mean to people who have experienced visitations from loved ones, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know about you, but I'm not willing to sit here with no evidence, let alone proof, and tell somebody that their dream visitation from their grandmother that was particularly impactful to them was some lying interdimensional alien. Like, you'd have to be some kind of monster, right? Like,
yeah.
Absolutely. So I think that while recognizing commonalities is important and it can be fruitful, like, we can't fall for that temptation to take the easy way out all of the time and try to find these blanket explanations that you can fit anything into, only because we make them so impossibly broad that you could fit anything into them, you know? And that's like ultra-terrestrials and such.
And because you're wearing your fun ruiner hat, let's keep it on for a minute. I mean, Paul, this was something, maybe it was on your list of things to talk about, but it's certainly something I feel strongly about. You know, the link between Mothman and the collapse of the Silver Bridge.
Oh, yes.
Which we have, you know, Gray Barker and then John Keel to thank for. Again, you know, you talk about a fallacy. Mothman is inextricably linked with that tragedy and with others now, essentially because of the work of a couple of writers that I honestly think it's kind of irresponsible to have even made that connection. And we talked to primary sources in Point Pleasant, people that lived in the area at the time. And until those two books, The Silver Bridge and Mothman Prophecies, came out, they did not link the Mothman sightings with the bridge collapse at all.
Mm. Well, I know when after the last time me and myself and Tobias spoke, we were talking about the fallacy of Mothman being the harbinger of doom.
Mm-hmm.
And you can trace this back to the Mothman Prophecies film. It doesn't before that.
And Tobias did, in fact. He did an excellent interview, which is forms the basis of a chapter in the book Tobias wrote, about with Richard Haydom, who wrote the movie, right, Tobias?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And so, funny story, if you've ever heard of the Blackbird of Chernobyl, yes. I love doing this because people will bring that one up and, you know, I go, okay, cool. Well, what's your primary source? Because it can't be internet rumors. So what's your primary source for the Blackbird of Chernobyl? Where are the eyewitnesses? How far back can you trace people talking about this? And you can't find any mention of it prior to that movie, because Richard Haydom made it up for the movie because he needed in his story some other examples of Mothman being at disasters, and he just picked Chernobyl because it was, he's writing it in the late 90s. Like, Chernobyl wouldn't have been that long ago. It was still in the public, you know, consciousness. It was a big deal. Mm. And so he picked that. He picked that and the Galveston, Texas yes. hurricane. And the Galveston, yes. Texas thing, that never took off. You don't hear about the Blackbird of no. Galveston, Texas no. or anything, but you hear about Chernobyl.
Especially, it sounds credible, doesn't it, Tobias? It's got enough of a, you can tell someone that earnestly and they'll be like, yeah, that tracks. That makes sense. Blackbird of Chernobyl. It makes complete sense. Until you actually do the legwork, which of course Tobias did. So
yeah.
I can see why people would believe it. And there are sites out there that parrot the story as though it's fact. Mm-hmm. And it took, you know, just a little bit of questioning to show that for the falsity that it was.
Absolutely. I mean, I've also, with another layer on top of that particular bugbear for all of us, it would seem, that one of the excuses people put forward for some of the records not being searchable or nobody can locate them is because obviously at the time Chernobyl was part of the Soviet Union and mm-hmm. therefore everything was suppressed and they've destroyed it all. And that's why we can't find these, because it's been destroyed. Not it didn't exist and it never happened. It's once again, it's a conspiracy, surely.
Yeah. It's an event so secretive that HBO made a four-part right. miniseries delving into the realities, but yes. missed the Blackbird.
Yes, yes.
Mm.
Especially for us that lived through it, Richard, because I think you were in the UK at the time. Because we
actually was, yeah.
There was
precisely one Mothman report from Fukushima, prior to Fukushima as well.
Mm.
You know, and so you always have to be very careful when you have a data point of one.
Yes.
So, you know, it's not so remarkable that a person would claim to have seen Mothman at that event. It's far more remarkable that thousands of others didn't notice this broad daylight sighting of a, you know, a winged humanoid buzzing the soon to be melted down power plant.
Mm. Well, I think that's one of the problems, is that sometimes these fallacies just seem to grow legs and just run away. And it doesn't seem... How many times anybody tries to sort of kill them, they just go away for a bit and then they just seem to come back. And then you're like, oh, didn't we go through this 5 years ago? How many times do we have to keep repeating this didn't happen?
We want to believe. I mean, people mm. want to believe. Hell, we want to believe. We went to Point Pleasant to buy us a Mothman burrito. You know, I mean, we're all in on this. We want to believe it, but we also, you know, have to ask the hard questions. And we did that. And I will say, this isn't a book that debunks the Mothman phenomenon any more than it's one that solves the Mothman phenomenon. It just aims to show, to hopefully shed a little bit of fresh light on this
right.
high strangeness.
As I'm fond of saying, if we don't explain the things that we can, why would anybody believe us about the things that we can't? And so it is so important for each and every one of us to do our due diligence in researching and investigating these subjects to allow them any kind of credibility whatsoever. And I fully understand that there is a sizable segment of the audience that is interested in these subjects who do not care if they're real or not. They just want to be entertained. And that's okay too. And hopefully... you know, like you are like you can still have fun with anything that I produce, even if I'm doing it with my fun ruiner hat on. You know, you can still find some entertainment in that. But for everybody who does care, and I am one of those people, I care a lot if any of this is actually real. Then, you know, that I want those people to know that if I'm saying something, and I'm sure this goes for Richard as well, because he does great work, that you can trust that it is not automatically BS, that it is not just the endless repetition of some rumor that has not been verified, that actual work has gone into this and there is a level of authenticity to it. And if there is not, then we are going to let you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's vitally important, because this scene is awash with exaggeration, miscommunication, and invention, essentially. In all aspects of it, doesn't matter what particular facet of the weird we talk about, there are always these purveyors of nonsense that sometimes explode. Strangely enough, I was given a presentation about The Beast of Bray Road. One of the key aspects of that is obviously the Gable film, which was put forward as a real footage of an attack and was essentially forensically destroyed by Linda Godfrey and Doug Hycheck, much to the DJ's annoyance who thought he'd pulled a fast one on them. When I was doing some research the other week, I fell down this rabbit hole on IMDb where you'd got one guy just ranting how it was a massive cover-up, the film was real, everybody who's denying it is a liar. And I thought, well, we're nearly 20 years on and this guy's still sticking to his belief that the Gable film is real. Even if you look at it on a filmatic level, you can see where the frames have been spliced together. It doesn't run properly. So it doesn't even work on a basic animal attack video. You can clearly see it's been stitched together.
I mean, all I can say is, living here in the US, let's not get started on denial of the evidence and conspiracy theories. Because my blood pressure is high enough.
It's a lot less funny in the current political climate.
But I will say, as a general principle, it's always wise to ask who benefits and why. So, you know, Tobias and I are selling a book. Whenever money is changing hands, whenever someone is asking you to consider or believe something and there is gain in it for them, be it monetary, fame, reputation, all of the above, it's always wise to question their findings. I think that's entirely appropriate and it behooves us to do so. And so, you know, the field of cryptozoology, Mothman in particular, but there are also a lot of very earnest researchers out there who are putting boots on the ground and are doing their best to try and unpick this conundrum.
I suppose for you, Richard, that one of the best aspects of probably your experience in the paranormal field is the amount of legends and stories that get built up about properties or hauntings and backstories that get invented. And I would, as we were saying about this kind of recreation or repackaging of the Mothman history and his bad omen that seemed to follow him wherever he is. It's the kind of thing you see time and time again when we talk about some of the classic ghost stories. It's always a specific character. It's always a tragic end. It's always a heartbroken bride throwing themselves out of a window in certain states.
Yeah, it's a trope, isn't it? I mean, there are so many tropes out there. The white lady, the grey lady, you know, things of that nature. Mothman has become a trope every bit as much as the Banshee has become a trope. And that's fine as far as it goes. I mean, for me, the challenge is, you know, there is something going on here and I am damned if I know what it is. So I'll be very open about that before anyone buys the book. Will you find answers in it? Yeah, but you'll find more questions. I mean, Tobias and I both made the point that, you know, some of these sightings can absolutely be explained away by misidentifications of large birds, sandhill cranes, things of that nature, but by no means all of them. Mm-hmm. And so once you wade through that kind of stuff, there is still this core which defies easy explanation. And that's the core that I think we're all interested in.
Yeah. I think one of the frustrations, I think, sometimes when we talk about weirdness or cases of high strangeness, Richard, is that often people will put forward a logical, normal explanation, like you say, like a sandhill crane. I've seen people put forward it was a certain breed of owl. And because it's normal or a simpler explanation, people will accept it, as you say, even though you can begin to quickly point out aspects, especially with Mothman, that simply couldn't be the case because of certain aspects of the case and certain interactions with people. You can see that a lot. It's the same as saying everybody that sees Bigfoot sees a brown bear stood up for some
reason. Which undoubtedly some of them are, but you're absolutely right.
Absolutely.
And I think it's dangerously simplistic. To say that because something can be explained in a certain way means that it can always be explained in a certain way. You know, I mean, again, going back to my medical job, sometimes, often, if you have bad chest pain, it's a heart attack. But there are a number of other causes. And I don't always leap to the conclusion that someone whose chest hurts is having a heart attack. I ask more questions. I do more thorough assessments. And so the same is my approach to phenomena also, Paul, you know. Yeah, absolutely. Some of these cases have very natural, simple explanations. Mm-hmm. But a number of them don't, or at least they defy easy explanation. And those are the ones we wanted to take a closer look at.
I mean, the one thing that really surprised me, because obviously I've always had an eye on enviously at the amount of wonderful cryptid festivals that there are in the States. And obviously you guys take a road trip out to last year's, I think it was, at Point Pleasant, which is just recently happened again. I was amazed to see this year that Richard Hatton, it was the first time he'd ever attended it. And he could not believe what Mothman has become. He was absolutely blown away by it. And I couldn't believe, as someone who's, for me, is one of the key proponents of Mothman and keeping it relevant and keeping it as a 40 and top 10 character, really, that he'd never been there. Would that surprise both of you, knowing and having spoken to Richard and the power that that film has based on Keel's work, that he's taken this long to get there?
Yeah, I'd say I'm a little surprised, honestly. You know, it came up in our conversation that he'd never been out there. You know, I'll say he has a real appreciation for the culture that has arisen around the Mothman phenomenon, how Mothman has been sort of adopted as a symbol by like certain marginalized communities. You know, he really talked a lot about how great that was, he thought. And so, yeah, I mean, it is a little surprising given his, you know, his level of interest and his commitment and how much he just sort of enjoys it. But then you realize that this is the United States and he lives in California and West Virginia is on like the other side of the country. And it makes a little more sense at that point, you know. And sometimes, you know, I know from personal experience, sometimes people are just waiting to be invited, or, you know, like you get caught up in things and you're waiting for your moment. So, who knows? But I think it's great he finally got out there. I might have tried to make a special trip if I would have known in advance he was going to be there. We've only ever spoken, you know, like this via the internet. Being able to meet in real life would have been great.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be his last visit going on. He seemed genuinely amazed, and he could clearly feel the love, because I think for a lot of people he's one of the rock stars of Mothman, really.
He is, and they have a bunch of memorabilia and props from the movie in the Mothman Museum, which I recommend everybody visit if you're in Point Pleasant, you know. And if ever a man deserves the chance to bask in a little bit of adoration, it's Richard in Point Pleasant, I think.
Yeah, it's a strange film for me because, as we were saying at the beginning of the conversation, talking about unconscious bias and believing we're open-minded, I have to say, the first time I watched the film when it came out, I absolutely hated it because it wasn't as much like the book as I wanted it to be.
Yeah, it's not linear, is it? It's it's a tough watch. It really is. And I think, by the way, Richard did a great job writing that movie.
Oh, yes.
But it's all but impossible to understand it the first time you watch it.
Yeah.
It demands your attention. It demands at least a second view.
Absolutely. Well, that was the thing. My partner kept saying, I want to watch it. I've not seen it. I was like, and I was umming and ahhing because I'd got this negative response to it. When I rewatched it about 18 months ago, I absolutely loved it this time because I've got it now. I was the problem, Richard. The film wasn't the issue. It was me.
I think in many ways too, the film is before its time. I really do.
Yes.
I think that film enjoys, I don't think it did great in movie theaters, but it enjoyed a very rich afterlife on DVD.
Yeah.
Very much to that today, you know, people still find the Mothman story and that's their entry point is through that movie.
How did you find the festival then, Richard? Because I would imagine you've probably spoken at cryptid-themed paranormal conferences or you've been on the agendas of certain events where you've had people speaking about other cryptids and things outside of the paranormal or even UFOs. So it's not like you're not used to seeing people dressed up as all kinds of scary creatures and monsters. But I would imagine when it's so focused on one particular thing, it must be incredible to view. I mean, it's on my bucket list because so many people travel from all over the world to go.
Yeah, we randomly ran into a couple of Brits as we were walking through the TNT area, and I recognized their accents and I stopped to just interview them. So I have a great deal of affection for Point Pleasant and the people there. So when I say what I'm about to say, it is by no means a criticism. It's just an observation. Mm. But Point Pleasant is a town that has one card and plays it hard. And that card is Mothman, you know, everything from the big chrome statue to the festival, and more power to them, by the way. But, you know, Tobias and I and our fellow researchers, Aaron and Mike Taylor, who were there with us, we went into the shops. You know, I was looking for a piece of Mothman memorabilia for my wife, and because I don't like sleeping on the couch when I come back from a trip empty handed. So I got speaking to this lady that she was a Point Pleasant original, born and raised there. And I asked her what she thought Point Pleasant would be like without Mothman. And she just very matter-of-factly said, no one would come here. Mm. And I think she's right. Honestly, I really, really do. I mean, it is about as small town, relatively small town America as it gets. The Silver Bridge is, I think, it's a key part of the town's history. It has scarred Point Pleasant, but they've done a wonderful job of honoring the bridge, those victims' memories, you know, with murals and with memorials. But I think that Mothman is what brings almost everybody into that town. Yeah. You know, so and I've seen on my travels through the U.S., there are a lot of towns that are that way. Atchison, Kansas, the Sally House, one of the allegedly most haunted houses, is also the birthplace of Amelia Earhart. Mm-hmm. And a lady in the Business Bureau told me very, you know, without batting an eyelid, she said, Sally brings more people to Atchison than Amelia does. And Amelia Earhart was real. There's no evidence that Sally was or is. So it kind of fascinates me to see, you know, these towns that build up this thriving kind of cottage industry around certain things. And again, that's by no means criticism of Point Pleasant. They go all in on Mothman. They go hard at it. And you get to the town and you learn it actually has quite a rich history. And, you know, the argument has been made by historians that the first engagement of the Revolutionary War or War of Independence, depending on which side of the Atlantic your listeners are on, really took place in Point Pleasant.
Yes.
Which led, of course, to the supposed curse by Chief Cornstalk. Yes. And things of that nature. So I hope that Mothman brings in many visitors. And I hope that while they're there, in addition to doing the touristy things like putting money into Mothman's butt crack and going to the TNT area and buying a t-shirt, I hope they take some time to appreciate the rich history and culture that is on offer in that town.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's a fair point, Richard. And Tobias, you'll know this better than most because you've spoken at several monster-themed conferences up and down it. And you mention another prime example, like Richard refers to, about having one card and playing it hard. Van Meter is a prime example of a town in the middle of nowhere that no one with the greatest, unless they lived somewhere near it, would know anything about apart from the fact that we've got the Van Meter monster and we've got the work that Chad Lewis, Kevin Lee Nelson and Noah Voss did in regards to that incredible case. Because once again, you've got another small town in the grip of a very strange situation that also is quite weird in the way these things happen, because this one seemed to be so localized over such a quick period of time, and it doesn't seem to have, we've not had any recurrence or sporadic outbreaks of strange people people seeing a strange dragony type flying leathery creature flying about, that it saved the place. Van Meter is now known because it has the monster.
Listeners, if you listen very carefully, you can hear the sound of a man putting on a fun ruiner hat.
It's true. I mean, I have so many thoughts on all of this. I mean, like, first of all, when it comes to small towns and Monster Fest, like, I, on the one hand, I think that's great. You know, like, they appreciate these stories. And, yeah, I mean, to be perfectly frank, to Richard's point, a town like Point Pleasant would probably be bankrupt by now if they didn't have Mothman to lean on, because nobody would go there for anything else. Of course they wouldn't. Why would they? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, too often you see because of the influence of this capitalistic ideal, right, of trying to capitalize on this monster, you see people trying to take ownership of it. And yes, that is just the height of hubris to me. The idea that Mothman belongs to any small town anywhere is so insane. This phenomenon, whatever it is, if it belongs to anything, it belongs only to itself. And it's going to do what it's going to do, and it's going to do it where it's going to do it. And the idea that there's any particular loyalty to just one specific town anywhere is ludicrous. And even going back to the 1960s, when that original flap that people, you know, claim to be so fond of was happening, it wasn't just happening in Point Pleasant. It was all along the Ohio River Valley. Yes. And so the idea that somehow, like, this story should be owned by a particular town is an affront to authenticity for me. So I love that they have a festival. I don't love the attitude of this is our story, this is our monster, and it can't possibly exist outside of the sphere of our influence, because that, to me, sounds like somebody who doesn't actually believe in any of this or care if it's real. Because if you do, you would know better, and you would know we don't have any say in this particular phenomenon. We don't have any say in what it does, where it lives, and we sure as hell don't own it. So, you know, maybe lighten up a little bit, I guess. But beyond that, you know, I mean, it's true, though. Like, people get weird about it. I was at Van Meter just this past weekend, and I had a person come up to me. They were perfectly pleasant, but, like, literally they started the conversation at my table with, like, well, I get really defensive when people talk about Mothman outside of Point Pleasant. And I'm just like, but why, though? Who cares? You know, like, these things are not married to each other outside of a product that you have been sold. You know, if you actually care about the truth, or if any of this is real, then you have to divorce yourself from whatever this product is that's being marketed to you, because that's not how the truth works. You know, you have to follow the story wherever it leads, not just where you want it to or where the person selling it to you says it's supposed to go. And so, you know, that's one of the big issues we have with Mothman right now, unfortunately. You know, it's not like Van Meter hasn't, I think, taken off in the way that Mothman has. So you don't really see anything like that there. And like Richard says, there are, I think actually maybe Paul, you made this point. There really hasn't been a continuation of the phenomenon in Van Meter, Iowa. So you've got these 19th century newspaper reports, and that's pretty much that's the entire story. And when I see a bunch of 19th century newspaper reports, you know, again, fun ruiner hat firmly in place, I don't give them a bunch of credibility, because newspapers at that time were known for telling tall tales. They would do it for a variety of reasons, could be anything from trying to drum up tourism to just having some fun, or a local rivalry with another small town where they're constantly trying to one-up each other with wild stories. Who knows? yeah. But I talked to, you know, I'm friends with Chad Lewis, and I'm friends with Kevin Nelson. And I talked to Kevin about this while we were there a little bit. And he had told me that when they were researching their first Van Meter visitor book, that they'd actually been able to speak to somebody who knew the the people involved, like they were very old, obviously, at the time that the book was written.
Yes.
But they at least had a first person connection, somebody who could say, okay, the people that are mentioned in these newspaper articles really existed, and this is what they were like. So that makes it a little more interesting, you know, like maybe there was something strange going on. Who knows? Not everything written in a newspaper, you know, prior to the mid 20th century was just an outright lie. So stranger things have happened, probably.
Yeah. Well, it's a strange thing you both touch on there, because I was reading the other day that obviously Barry in Canada has had to instigate legal action because apparently somebody's tried to copyright their lake monster. And they were like, hang on a minute, it doesn't belong to you, it belongs to us. And so they've had to go to court because someone's tried to file a copyright on, is it Campenfelt Katie? I believe they call their lake monster. And somebody's obviously thought, oh, I can make a quick buck here. And the council have gone, no chance. This is our monster, it's not yours. And so they've had to instigate legal protection once again for a creature we can't prove exists, but somebody's trying to steal.
That's reprehensible. I don't understand that. And honestly, I like how you frame that too, because, you know, maybe it isn't that, say, like Point Pleasant owns Mothman, like, and maybe that it isn't that Mothman can only own itself. Maybe because the lens through which we view this is human consciousness, and frankly, that's the only way we seem to be able to experience this or record it or anything, then maybe it belongs to all of us, and that's a better way to put it. You know, maybe all of these phenomena belong to all of us, and anybody trying to take ownership of them and exploit them for their own personal gain, to the exclusion of other people. You know, you want to have a festival, you want to write a book, you want to make a stuffed animal or something. I think that's all swell. I will enjoy every bit of it. But if you want to try to take ownership of one of these phenomena to the exclusion of other people, to try to get some kind of exclusive right to something that, like, you, no person possibly could or should. Yeah, that's pretty gross. I don't think I can support that. I know that's a very brave stance to take, but I'm going to take it anyway.
Well, it's not surprising though. I mean, Memphrey is another one, and I'm not sure if you've come across this, Tobias, that Lake Memphreyog in Canada has one of the most cited lake monsters in Canada. But unless you know about lake monsters in Canada, you probably don't know about Memphrey, because there's one researcher there who has collected all the reports and refuses to release them, which I don't
understand.
That
is a real shame. Yeah, I don't understand it either. And you encounter that far too often. And it's not just cryptids. You see it a lot in ufology. Yeah, might be the actual worst discipline specifically for this. The, I know the truth, but I can't tell you. Well, then what good is it then? You know, like, if you
but
can't tell me, you don't know anything.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. Hashtag disclosure coming any day now, I promise.
Well, I'm really confused, because in the last 3 weeks, we've had an alien invasion that somebody predicted that didn't happen. We've had two raptures that didn't happen. Well, as far as I'm aware, didn't happen. And when you've been in these weird subjects for so long, you kind of think, aren't we here again? Because this was all happening in the 90s, especially with the UFOs. And then it was all going to happen again in the noughties. It didn't happen. I mean, I'm sick to death of saying, it's all going to happen tomorrow. It's all going to happen tomorrow. Because that was the kind of thing that really gave me a tarnished view of ufology by the end of the 90s. I used to wake up in cold sweats if I heard the word Roswell. I was sick to death of it. Or alien abduction. I was just thinking, we're just talking about the same thing over and over and over again. And so I think it can be quite confusing, and you can kind of understand why people who might be interested in certain subjects are put off by this gatekeeping that seems to exist. As you say, ufology is probably the worst example of it, because people always have the truth and they can't share it, but they know it. Dogman's a bit like that as well, because I've seen people say, I've got the best ever footage. It categorically proves it's real, but I won't release it, which I just cannot get my head around. Why would you not want to be a millionaire overnight?
I mean, that's a great question. I definitely would be. You know, yeah. You're right though. Like, you do see it a lot, and it's a dang shame. You know, I got my start in UFOs, like investigating UFOs.
Yes.
And you see it all the time. And so people will ask me, they'll say, "Well, aren't you excited about disclosure? You know, like, what do you think about this new government thing?" Well, you know, the answer to that is usually, well, the government's lying to you because they're just trying to cover something else up. That's always like the government, like specifically the U.S. like Department of Defense and intelligence agencies have always used UFOs to just confuse the issue surrounding something else that they didn't want the public to know about. That doesn't mean that UFOs aren't real. That doesn't mean that there isn't a real phenomenon there that can't be comfortably explained. But it does mean that we should not care what the government has to say about UFOs. That's just asinine. If you want the truth about UFOs, go outside. Like, literally just go outside at night. You know, like, go sky watching, try a CE5 experiment. Who cares? You know, like, yeah. Go leave your house, right? Like, that's the only way you'll even have a chance ever of getting anywhere close to being able to see the truth about UFOs. And that goes for every single one of these other phenomena too. You know, don't let anybody ever tell you that you can't investigate Dogman or Mothman or Bigfoot or lake monsters or ghosts or anything you want. They're not the boss of you, and they don't own any of this stuff. You want to look into it? Go look into it.
Yeah, it's certainly better than making glorified murder scenes as saleable items, as I'm sure Richard has an opinion on because of some of
the... Oh, you are trying to bait me tonight, huh?
No, not at all. Yeah. I'm just... Because I completely agree with it, with what your point was, Richard, because, and I'm sure you might have seen this, Tobias, some of the stuff that's getting put forward as memorabilia for the Valeska is, you know, I've got a pretty strong stomach and I like weird stuff and I have an interest in true crime. That, for me, is so far over a line of taste that... It's ridiculous.
There's a thin line between, you know, commenting and offering insight on true crime and exploitation. Mm. And I'm someone that has written books about, you know, true crime. I'm someone that's written books about the link between crime and the paranormal. And I fully understand that some people may find even associating a haunting with a murder scene to be distasteful.
Yes.
So I try and be as, to tread as lightly as I can when I write those books. But purely my opinion, but putting the faces of murdered children on axe heads that you sell in a gift shop, having a gift shop at a murder scene like that is immensely disrespectful and distasteful to me. And, you know, what's the old saying about obscenity? I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, and I see
yes,
it.
Absolutely. And I mean, you get this sometimes with all kinds of aspects of it, but it's not something I would have expected to start drip feeding into this, because obviously one of the other aspects is I've seen people try to explain Valeska away in the paranormal, which I think completely takes it away from the heinous crime that it was, because I think that one of the strangest things about that is it's not an isolated incident. We don't know if the perpetrator of that particular crime was involved in others, but there are dozens of cases of that nature in that era, which I think itself is an incredible series of circumstances that's ripe for Fortean research, because whilst it is crime, you have to say, why were people doing that? Why was it happening so often? And why did it just stop? Because it's very... I just cannot get my head around these kinds of weird flaps where you've got this. And Valeska is the tip of the iceberg. There's dozens of them.
Yeah, and the books that I would recommend people look at in regard to this are Murdered in Their Beds by Troy Taylor. The Man from the Train. Those are two books which look at a larger scale, a more macro scale than the individual cases themselves. So, but I've written about Amityville as well extensively, and I tread lightly with this case as well. But I will say this, the so-called Amityville Horror, the most horrific thing about that case is that the murders of a house full of innocent people in cold blood as they slept in their beds has been used to launch a multi-million dollar movie franchise. There are something like 50 odd Amityville movies at this point, including Amityville in Space. Yes. I did not make that up. And so, you know, it all kind of rests on this bedrock of human tragedy, and the real people, the human tragedy, is often forgotten, again, in the pursuit of cash and fame.
Yes.
That's the real horror of Amityville, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think sometimes you can see those kinds of strange things, because like I say, I think that the Amityville Horror is the default situation. That is it for me.
Yeah.
And like you say, Richard, people seem to forget that six people were murdered, four of whom were children.
Mm.
And once again, it gets wrapped up in the mystery and the stories that come after it. And I think people just need to take a step back. But I think there is a sea change in the way that true crime is dealt with these days. It certainly seems to be getting less glory and more focus on the actual victims these days, which I think is only a good thing. Really.
Well, I think there's a lot that we can learn from the study of such things.
Yes.
There is, again, a big difference between study, education, and exploitation, you know, and we can tell when that line has been crossed. And it's a pretty safe bet that if there's a gift shop and merchandise involved, that line has been crossed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think lastly, gentlemen, before I let you return to your evenings, there are some numerous contributors throughout the book. Was this a case, Tobias, Richard, that you sat down with a list of the people whose opinions and thoughts you were interested in, or whose opinions you respected and you wanted to sort of postulate the possibilities of these particular cases? Because obviously, whilst we're talking about Mothman and Point Pleasant, you also touch on the incidents that you've researched previously in and around Lake Michigan, as we've spoken on previous episodes, Tobias, as well as I touched on Van Meter and other sporadic outbreaks of these. And you've got some of the most learned and intelligent people when it comes to talking about strange creatures and the possibilities in the Fortean world, as we've touched on, amongst others, Chad, Joshua, Ken Gerhard appears as well. Did you have a designated go-to list, or was it a case of I know who I need?
I think I'll go first on this, I guess. I think before we started, I had a list of people that I knew that I wanted to include, and then I talked with Richard about it, and he brought up some other folks too. And as a result, that's how we sort of settled on the people that we managed to get involved. Now, I don't think I got to speak with, okay, it's impossible to interview everybody you could ever want to interview on this subject and put it into one book. So yes. Anybody who wasn't interviewed, or anybody who reads it and is like, well, why didn't you talk to this person? Well, it's because there's a word count limit, right? You know, like it can't be encyclopedia sized. And so I understand that there are people who have valuable insights and opinions on this phenomenon, but I am very happy with the people that we did speak with. You know, Brent Rains was great. He had a personal relationship through correspondence with John Keel. So that was very insightful. Obviously, as you mentioned, Chad Lewis is absolutely fantastic. You know, Josh Kuchin is, yeah, absolutely. Josh Kuchin is a friend of mine. It was great to have him involved. Ken Gerhard, another friend of mine. Great to have him involved. They're kind of opposite sides of the same cryptozoological coin. So I think it was nice to have both of those perspectives. So you've got Josh for the high strangeness, and you've got Ken for the more sort of grounded scientific, like, materialism. David Weatherly writing the foreword, we owe him a huge debt. He was just great about it. And David's he's a fantastic guy too. And he knows a hell of a lot about this subject as well, honestly. So just, you know, everybody top to bottom that was involved from that standpoint was great. Also, you know, being able to speak with witnesses. I mean, I think that they're the most valuable contributors, frankly. And, you know, we were able to speak with some of the witnesses that I'd worked with before. And that was great to have Richard present for that, because, you know, he asked questions that I had never even thought of. You know, having that sort of outsider perspective, I think, was very, very valuable. But it also goes to show that this is a real phenomenon, whether, like, whatever you think it is, whatever you think it represents, it is a real thing happening to real people. And thus it has value. Thus, it's something that we need to take more seriously than, you know, memes on the frickin' internet, you know?
Absolutely. Well, one of your strengths with the work that you've done previously, yourself and Emily, Tobias, is always you put the witness at the heart of your investigation, which a lot of people don't do. And often you can see the witness's story being taken away from them, as we were talking about gatekeeping earlier, and it becomes whoever's investigated. It's their story now, and you see this a lot. Probably not as much as it used to, but I think it's easier to call out people these days. But I mean, it is one of your great strengths, is the fact that you let the witness tell the story rather than you tell a version of their events, really. And it shines through every page in the book. Like I said to you at the beginning, gentlemen, it's a fantastic collection. You've got a wonderful way of working together with Richard's fresh eyes on old subjects for people like ourselves, Tobias, who have been sort of swimming through the world of high strangeness for many a year. And so I congratulate you both on it, and I hope it's not the last time you work together in this field.
I would be devastated.
Well, there's some fun out there waiting to be ruined.
So we can ruin it together.
We can, man. You know the band Foreigner? We are just a couple of verbs away. Fun ruiner. US right. Tour 2026. But no, it was a delight working with Tobias. It really was. I learned so much. It was a great adventure. I feel that this book was, you're always wary about co-authoring with anybody, right? No matter who they might be. But this worked so well hand in glove. I don't think there was a single disagreement. You know, there were certainly some differences in perspective, but the adventure was a wonderful one. And, you know, Tobias has a great way of, we were out in the TNT area in the dark at night, and he's great for context. So I remember him saying, you got to understand, Richard, that, you know, back in 1967, this would have been full of cars and full of people with keggers and shotguns. Yeah. The most American night out ever. And they're all looking to take a pot shot at the Mothman, all these weird lights in the sky, which everyone forgets when they recount the Mothman story. You know, so you got to imagine a kind of bohemian party atmosphere here. Yeah. And I'm in the middle of this nature reserve with these, you know, creepy igloos made of cement. And I'm just like, wow, yeah, that really has changed my perspective of all this. So it was a pleasure to do. And I would saddle up and go on another adventure with Tobias anytime.
Excellent. I would, get those fun killer hats on, chaps. And I think your next destination should be Fresno. And you can kill that particular cryptid.
Nightcrawlers.
That's right.
Or whatever it was. So, gentlemen, thank you again for your time. Where can everybody get a copy of your latest book? And what have you got coming next for us?
I'll go first. You can get a copy of Mothman from obviously the usual online retailers, and I'd also remind you that your local independently owned bookstore can order it in for you, and I'm sure they would very much appreciate your custom. You can see me at ComCon 8 in Virginia City in 2 weeks' time. So get to investigate the old Washoe Club with me and people like Aaron Sagers and MJ Dixon and Shane Pittman. Then I'll be doing a little filming, and spooky season is in full swing.
Excellent.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, everything Richard just said, of course, you know, wherever you buy weird books, you can find this Mothman book. And I do think you should support your local weird book seller. So if you've got a shop that you like, have them order it for you. I will be next at the Goatman Festival down in Louisville, Kentucky. That's I know. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's I love going down there.
Richard.
I see what you did there. It's a great little festival. And, you know, it's always a lot of fun. I love going down there. Louisville is a great city. But that is October 11th. And then, you know, if you're interested, and of course I'll have copies of the book there. If you happen to be in the Louisville area, come pick one up, get it signed. And I've got a book signing coming up November 9th down in Chicago at the Sideshow Gallery, which should be pretty exciting. So that's a pretty cool little haunted hub for people who appreciate the weird and anomalous. So, you know, go check that out. Support them. They're a local bookseller, you know, like they're going to be selling, like stocking like this book for sure. And then, you know, maybe some other ones that I've written. Who knows? Probably some other ones other people have written, but we're not here to talk about that. So,
well, listen, it's always a pleasure spending time in your company, especially when I get twice the fun on the same conversation. So thank you both for fitting me into your hectic schedules. I wish you the very best of luck. And I look forward to the next time I get to speak to you either together or separately on your next projects. And I wish you all the best for the remainder of our favourite season of the year.
Take care.
Thanks so much.